While you are busy enjoying your lunch, while you are busy having some time from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the Radio News Analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening. We ask why it's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relations, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia. Make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM, the eye.
A very good afternoon, Namibia, and a warm welcome to listeners joining us from across the country and beyond our borders. Thank you for tuning into Eagle FM, the home of insightful conversation and real national dialogue. I'm your host, Ndafa Happy Juju, and this is On The Reader News Analysis. It is Friday, and the time is 5 minutes past the hour of 1300 hours. Now, as the week draws to a close, daily life across Namibia continues at full pace. Communities are reflecting on the week's developments while preparing for the weekend ahead, balancing responsibilities, expectations, and the realities of a dynamic national environment. Across the country, conversations remain centered on the cost of living, service delivery, public safety, health, and economic recovery. Now, those issues continue to shape household decisions, business confidence, and public discourse as Namibia navigates the early months of the new year. Welcome to On The Radar News Analysis, your trusted source for the latest news and updates in Namibia and beyond, where we bring you comprehensive news coverage, breaking stories, in-depth analysis, and exclusive reports that place context at the center of every headline. Now, our live stream services delivers real-time updates on current affairs, politics, business, technology, health, entertainment, and more, keeping you informed wherever you are. Today's program focuses on key national and regional developments from the week, including public health, housing service delivery issues, economic trends, and community safety, as we reflect on what they mean for Namibians heading into the weekend. So stay informed, stay engaged, stay connected. This is On The Reader News, your reliable news partner. Now let's jump straight into today's top stories. The Ministry warned against illegal sand and gravel mining that is said to be taking place countrywide throughout the whole of Namibia. It's, of course, they are concerned in giving out a caution out there to the people to be cautious and to obviously make better choices. That is, the Ministry of Environment, Forestry and Tourism has expressed serious concern over the continued increase in illegal sand and gravel mining activities across various parts of Namibia, warning that such operations are taking place without the required environmental clearance certificate, also known as the ECCs. Now, in a statement, the ministry said the activities are being conducted in violation of the Environmental Management Act of 2007, which requires all sand and gravel mining operations to obtain an ECC, that is an environmental clearance certificate, from the Office of the Environmental Commissioner before commencement. The ministry stressed that no individual, business, local authority or traditional authority is permitted to undertake sand and gravel mining without first conducting an environmental impact assessment, developing an environmental management plan, and receiving formal approval in the form of environmental clearance certificate. Now, according to the ministry, illegal and gravel mining poses serious risks to the environment, the human life, livestock, and wildlife. Reported impacts include land degradation, erosion of riverbeds, damage to infrastructure, destruction of wetlands, and the loss of agricultural lands such as mango fields. Now, this effect threatens water and food security, grazing land, and biodiversity. The ministry further warned that open pits left behind by illegal mining operations fill with water during the rainy season, creating life-threatening hazards for people, particularly children, as well as for livestock and wildlife. Now, acknowledging the increasing demand for sand and gravel driven by national development projects such as roads, housing and other infrastructure, the ministry emphasized that development must not come at the cost of irreversible environmental damage. Now, the ministry announced that it will soon embark on regional stakeholder engagements on sand and gravel mining regulations aimed at strengthening the implementation and enforcement of the Environmental Management Act. The ministry called on all stakeholders to participate in this engagement and urged all Namibians to desist from illegal sand and gravel mining and to comply fully with existing environmental laws. Now, to get more on this and understand it much better and deeper, we caught up with Dr. Caroline Garus Oss. Pardon me, Dr. Caroline Haminer Garus Oss. She is the Deputy Environmental Commissioner in the Ministry, in the Line Ministry. Let's take a listen. Good afternoon, Dr. Carol, and welcome to On the Radar News Analysis.
Good afternoon, Dafa. Thank you for welcoming me. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Now, Doctor, I understand that the Ministry of Environment, Forestry and Tourism has issued warnings or caution against illegal sand and gravel mining, which they have noticed all throughout Namibia. Just how dangerous is this illegal sand and gravel mining?
Thank you for that very important question. And I think it's something that the wider public should also be informed about and cautioned on. So removing sand and gravel strips the land of its first line of defense, making land more vulnerable and exposed. Especially removing it from riverbeds alter the river flow, which leads to bank erosion and destruction of riparian habitats, even loss of spawning grounds for fish. And also unrehabilitated pits are frequented with rainwater and create deceptive death traps. So you have various animals and also sometimes even loss of human life. So they are quite deep and it's quite fatal most of the time. And children also tend to swim there and, you know, it could really lead to great losses. Stagnant water in abandoned and unrehabilitated pits also serve as primary breeding grounds for mosquitoes, Anopheles, for example, malaria-carrying mosquitoes, and could significantly, of course, increase vector-borne diseases like malaria, which I've mentioned. And also, when you have a lot of rainfall, for example, there's an influx of various contaminated for example, fecal matter that can find itself into these unrehabilitated pits, which can also pronounce waterborne diseases, for example, cholera, typhoid, hepatitis, et cetera, et cetera. So it's really a very big environmental and public health hazard for mining, for example, to go unregulated. And of course, at the end of the mining, when there's no rehabilitation, it really leads to all of these various problems. I mean, structural collapses, for example, also infrastructure collapses as well, houses, roads, et cetera, et cetera. So it's really a knock-off effect when you go about mining sand or gravel indiscriminately and when it's unregulated.
I understand that there is the act that is the sand and the gravel mining regulations under the Environmental Management Act 2007, Act 7 of 2007, and we are in 2026 now. Perhaps, are there any reviews in plan, any amendments in plan perhaps? What's the way forward with that?
So we have, of course, the Environmental Management Act number 7 of 2007, which we have over the years since 2015 been reviewing and, of course, amending. And the rationale behind this is basically practical challenges experienced during implementation. For example, we never had sand and gravel mining regulations. We have a clause in our Act, Section 27, Subsection 2D of the Act that speaks of resource removal. So every act has to have regulations. So we are using that clause to come up with, or came, or we use that clause to generate sand and gravel removal, or sand and gravel extraction, or sand and gravel excavation regulations, which we are now going to workshop in the wider public. I don't know if you want me to give you the program now, or the schedule now, but maybe that will come later as we have this discussion.
Yeah, probably.
So the Act, of course, has the current Act has quite a few challenges, which we would have to now sort of, I don't know what one would call it, maybe incorporate several changes to make it more robust and make it more, not obsolete. Obsolete means that there's nothing else afterwards. But
okay.
It's the rationale behind the amendment is emerging risk and climate change pressures, weak enforcement and compliance mechanisms, absence of strategic environmental assessment.
Let's make room for a scheduled commercial break. I will be back to continue.
Save so much more in 2026 at WB. Get 1 litre Clover Ultra UHT milk for $19.99. 1 kg Top Score Instant Maize for only $23.99. 500 gram Bacomo Cornflakes for only $29.99. And 8 Twin Saver 300 sheet 1 ply toilet rolls for only $33.99. See more January specials at vurmanbrock.com. We care.
Good afternoon, Dr. Carol, and welcome to On the Reading is
sort of like,
and perhaps what's the way forward with that?
So we have, of course, the Environmental Management Act number 7 of 2007, which we have over the years since 2015 been reviewing and, of course, amending. And the rationale behind this is basically practical challenges experienced during implementation. For example, we never had sand and gravel mining regulations. We have a clause in our Act, Section 27, Subsection 2D of the Act that speaks of resource removal. So every act has to have regulations. So we are using that clause to come up with, to generate sand and gravel removal, or sand and gravel extraction, or sand and gravel excavation regulations, which we are now going to workshop in the wider public. I don't know if you want me to give you the program now, or the schedule now, but maybe that will come later as we have this discussion.
Yeah, probably.
So the Act, of course, has the current Act has quite a few challenges, which we would have to now sort of, I don't know what one would call it, maybe incorporate several changes to make it more robust and make it more, not obsolete. Obsolete means that there's nothing else afterwards. But
okay.
It's the rationale behind the amendment is emerging risk and climate change pressures, weak enforcement and compliance mechanisms, absence of strategic environmental assessments, etc. So the amendment process was initiated in 2015. Initially, it was proposed to have a completely new act, but we decided to amend the current act. Peer reviews were done by the Center of Science and Environmental Health in India. The shortcomings which were identified were no legal provision, of course, like I said earlier onwards, for strategic environmental assessments, limited guidance on fines and enforcement procedures, inadequate categorization of listed activities, and, of course, to regulate environmental assessment practitioners. And, of course, there is this weak component of rehabilitation and restoration provision. So we are trying to have this act as close as possible to complete, because there's no such thing as complete. That's why we supplement through regulations.
Now, in terms of communities, and most of them obviously look at what they want, what they
think they need at that particular moment in time. They want to build their homes. They want to, and so then they go and mine, do sand mining. Just how perhaps can they be empowered to report or stop illegal mining activities?
You know, the growth in population in, exacerbates, of course, the need of sand and gravel, houses, infrastructure, roads, etc., etc. As we as human beings become more, we need more development. So that will not be something that will end anytime soon. We just have to really understand, like I've said earlier onwards, maybe just referencing to the various disadvantages of illegal or unregulated sand mining, the death traps, the waterborne diseases, etc., etc. So it's something that really needs to be regulated so that it's not going to cause all of these ills that I've spoken about earlier onwards. So the workshops that we're going to go around, the stakeholder engagements that we're going to have from the 26th, we are trying and hoping, especially through the media right now, to have the wider public and, of course, also experts, and of course also miners and every other OMA which has indirect or direct effects on sand mining, for example. So we are trying to draw as many people as possible, especially the wider public as well, so that they can come about and understand and provide their inputs on how we can really come up with regulations which are implementable in Namibia.
Now, reflecting back from the community where I come from, or the town where I'm from, there's a particular place there where it has now become sort of like a pit, a really, really, really big pit, you know, where people would take sand and for making bricks and selling them. But now, how do we counter that in such an instance where we really want to, of course, we can't really rectify it, but how can we now perhaps do something that would then make that pit not become such a danger to vulnerable children and animals, and also the vulnerable ecosystem?
So what we usually do with what we have right now, the sand and mining regulations are, they are not enforced yet because we are at the stakeholder engagement stage. However, we are using the clause within our act that speaks of resource removal. So we caution the public, and of course, we also have a memorandum of agreement with NAMPOL for them to assist us to regulate this resource as well. And of course, we have the environmental clearance certificate system in place. Mm-hmm. Anyone and everyone that would want to go about this activity has to submit an EIA and EMP, and that really allows us some insight on what exactly they would want to do with this. And there are rehabilitation clauses within all of our documents which speaks of what do you want to do with after mining, you know. So the EIA should really show how you are going to safeguard the environment and, of course, also enhance the environment, meaning do you have fencing around and you can only excavate to a certain level, et cetera, et cetera. And, of course, away from, we have buffer zones, away such 200 meters, for example, away from infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And, of course, also paying attention to indigenous species, not to, like camel thorn trees, for example, not to sort of encroach on such environments, et cetera, et cetera. So, and rehabilitation also speaks of leveling up again the area which you have pitted. And then also it speaks of repurposing or reusing whatever there is. So there are certain areas where there's excavation which you can actually turn it into something that that can be reused, for example, maybe a dam in a way, constructed in a way that is reusable, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay. Dr. Carol, what's the purpose of stakeholder engagements, and how will this the feedback during those engagements influence the regulation?
So the stakeholder engagements are intended to ensure transparency inclusivity, and informed decision-making. The ministry wants to hear directly from the interested and affected parties or communities, traditional authorities, local authorities, miners, and businesses about their experiences, concerns, and practical realities on the ground. So this will basically help to ensure that the regulations are realistic, fair, and responsive to local communities before they are finalized. So how will this now influence, or how will this feedback influence the regulations?
Yeah.
Of course, this regulations or this feedback will be carefully reviewed and documented, where appropriate concerns and suggestions will be incorporated into the final regulations. So this process ensures that the regulations are not only environmentally sound, but also practical and implementable. Stakeholder input is quite crucial, very critical part of refining enforcement mechanisms, compliance requirements, and transition arrangements. So it's really, really crucial, very important for us to really get the wider public to be part and parcel of these engagements.
Interesting. Doc, thank you so much for making time for us right here on the Radar News Analysis.
No problem. Always welcome.
Okay. Joining us now telephonically is Mr. Emmanuel Naukushu from Onekwaya East, and he is the sand mining representative of Okwanyama Traditional Authority. A very good afternoon to you, Mr. Naukushu, and welcome to On the Radar News Analysis.
Good afternoon, Ms. Gaffa, and welcome.
Of course, we're talking about illegal sand and gravel mining that is now happening across all parts of Namibia, and of which the ministry has sent out a concern and a warning. Just how have you welcomed this directive or this caution from the Ministry of Environment, Forestry and Tourism, Mr. Naukushu?
Well, the ministry itself has already established the that regulation of Act 2007, Article 7, so which is already accepted and respected by the traditional authority. So we have to cooperate with it and respect it.
Okay. Yeah. And in regards to what's happening on ground in the communities and in the villages, how would you say traditional authority plays its part in educating the people not to partake in sand and gravel, in illegal sand and gravel mining?
So we have to address them and to, so that they can avoid to take place illegal sand mining. So they are not allowed to mining everywhere without a CCE, which means Environment Clear Certificate. So they have to obtain it by applying through the traditional authority itself so that they can go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And the ministry is also planning to have regulations with and consult on the act, that is Act 7 of 2007. And of course, with this comes with consultations countrywide. Just perhaps, what is your say on that, and how do you perhaps intend, how do you think this will impact having the people from the communities having to give their input as well?
Yes, well, you see, well, the community itself is in need of buildings now, because the ministry itself of environment and tourism under the Department of Forestry is no longer allowed to cut down the trees as before for people to construct their houses. So they have to put up in the format of building made by the sands and the gravels. Now, so they have, if they go through of that,
yeah,
they have to go procedurally, because if they take illegal mining, some of them safety are not injured, and the business community which take place in sand mining also, their trucks or implements, so they must be in a good health or road worst trucks, so that they cannot cause accident.
That is true. Now, for some local people may feel like they're being restricted because they want to build their beautiful houses and they want to obviously make their homes up to modern standard. And now they might feel like they are limited as to not getting saint. And because obviously if they're not allowed to do that, then they will need to go and buy the saint. How perhaps maybe would you, from your opinion, how perhaps maybe would you say the ministry should go about this in terms of course, helping the community to adhere to the law, but then again, also helping the community to benefit in some sort of aspect from their own land?
You see, the ministry itself, I don't think it is prohibiting the community or the business people to take a sand mining.
Yeah.
Only because the ministry wants a clear certificate from the mine and the safety must be ensured. Because the people have to build, yes, they have to develop their countries and the job opportunity has to be created. Some of them are bricklayers and some of them are so constructing in that field. So it's sometimes creating job opportunities. I don't think the Ministry of Environment will prohibit it only procedurally, which they will take place for mining.
Mr. Nokushu, it surprises me, and actually it's a very good thing that there are sand mining representatives, and you being one of them as a sand mining representative. Just how, what has your work entail? What have you been able to do during the course of time, even before now that the ministry issued out this consent, because seeing that it's definitely not a new thing?
If they will fresh regulation through this consultation, which will be held on the 27th of this month at Enana, then maybe we have to stick on that. Only one thing, they are too slow, the ministry itself is too slow to provide or to consider our application from the transitional authority so that the environmental clear certificate can be issued. It will take almost 7 months. And so on. We are going to give you the input so that they can speed up a bit, so that the community can have a sand mining activities or places where can be mining. Because one thing which is causing the sand illegal sand mining is only the slowness of the ministry itself to consider the applications. So that they can be approved. It's only saying so. They have been pushing by the community because the community is in need of sand or gravel, but there's no mine to be mined for sand and the gravel materials.
Okay. Yeah. Lastly, Mr. Emmanuel Nokushu, your last words to the public and to the people out there, and of course to the communities and people in villages or all over all parts of Namibia who are partaking in illegal sand and gravel mining. Just your words to them.
Yeah, I just want to encourage them to be understand that if they are in their villages, come for proposal, maybe a place for sand mining, let them not be scared of that, because they are the self had to be consulted by the consultant and by myself through the headman of that place. Some of them be objective for them. They don't want for that mine because they said their cattle, animals will be fallen. It's dangerous to their children and so on. But it's not like that, because the procedure is there. We have to put some fence, and after mining, the mine area has to be rehabilitated. And some of them, they will keep their water during the rainy season. The pit will keep water. The borrow pit will keep water for the whole year for their animals. So they must just be patient, because the aim is just to develop the country through buildings, materials, schools, also using these materials, and the clinic is also using materials. If there's no sand, there's no construction or development in the country.
That's
so
true.
I encourage them just to be patient, because the borrow pit is not for individual, it's for the whole people of the country. That's my comment.
Okay. Mr. Emmanuel Naukusha, thank you so much for making time for us right here on the Reading News Analysis.
Thank you very much, Ndafa. Enjoy the day.
Okay. And there you had it from Emmanuel Naukusha. That is, he's from Onekwaya East, and he is the sand mining representative of Okwanyama Traditional Authority. Now, of course, we still right at the beginning of our conversation right here on the Reading News Analysis. More yet coming your way. But for now, let's pause right here and take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back shortly.
Want to know about Namibia's latest business and economic news? Then look no further than the Villager newspaper. The Villager is an e-paper that is published every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for free, directly to your phone or computer. To become a subscriber, simply send a WhatsApp message with your number and email address to 081-200-4144. Be sure to save the phone number as a contact. The Villager, wherever you are.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud. So
not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back. It's Friday, and that means that our Friday edition of the Villager e-paper is now available. Today's e-paper covers the following headlines. Congestion in transmission lines limits power trading in SAPP, that is the Southern African Power Pool, SAPP. Namibians likely to face continued lack of opportunities in 2026, according to WEF. Vodafone executives make AI heavy predictions for 2026. Total Energies and partner submit Asia and ESIA and ESMP for Venice Field. Balance infrastructure building and environmental protection, according to the minister. Verify your micro lender before you borrow. All this in our The Villager e-paper for this Friday. Now get your copy and read on the best news and more. That is the best social and economic news. Stay informed by subscribing to the Eagle Media House WhatsApp channel and receive a tri-weekly dose of economic, social and community news absolutely free of charge. Just send a text message to 081-200-4144 and never miss an update. Heading back onto our conversation, let's now take a listen to Myla Mwashindange. She's a geographic information systems and environmental management specialist. Here she's speaking on land degradation and the risk posed on both animals and children by illegal sand and gravel mining. Let's take a listen.
Good afternoon, Myla Mwashindange, and welcome to On the Reading News Analysis.
Afternoon, Happy. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. The Ministry of Environment has issued a stance warning or a serious concern over the continued increase in illegal sand and gravel mining activities across Namibia. Now, Myla, having dealt with environment or dealing with environment yourself or being an environmentalist yourself, from an environmental perspective, how serious is the threat posed by illegal sand and gravel mining in Namibia?
Happy, I think it's the biggest thing with any mining activity is always the risk of land degradation. Now, there's a higher risk with illegal mining activities because that means the activities are not regulated. And additional to that, there is probably little to no consideration to environmental impacts. You see open casts and open quarries being left unrehabilitated or restored, which in turn creates a risk for communities around. Especially with sand mining, it's especially common in rural areas, prominent in northern Namibia, where you've got free roaming domestic animals. And then you also have children running around, and especially now with the rainy season, you end up with sort of unofficial water dams. And that in itself is a risk because nobody knows the depth of those quarries, and that creates another risk of either animal drowning, children drowning. So it can be quite risky, to be honest, if mining activities are done without regulations.
Interesting. You speak about children and animal. What other perhaps risks do this sand mining and gravel illegal mining pose on biodiversity per se?
Well, in terms of biodiversity, remember when you are mining, you are mining takes away land. You take away material that is essentially where you've got small creatures growing, and those small creatures, the dung beetles, and these small creatures are usually what helps propagate vegetation. So because you've removed not just the topsoil, we've removed the land material, you lose biodiversity in terms of vegetation. And also in terms of nutrients relevant for that land to be able to have a life, you impact the ecosystem and the ecological functions of that area, because it's going unchecked, and there isn't alternatives to make sure that ecological function of the area is restored.
Now, for those who are benefiting at that particular time from this sand and gravel mining, or let's say illegal mining, how does that weigh long-term opposed to what they are benefiting in the meantime?
I think the socio-economic impact is quite quickly realized, to be honest, when it comes to illegal sand mining. So there's a very short term financial benefit to the person that gives over their land. So for instance, Happy, if you have land and somebody approaches you, they're constructing a road and they feel you've got suitable gravel for what they for the road construction that they are busy with. Mind you, because that process is not being done through the regulations, you will not necessarily get value for money, first and foremost. So you may get something in that you can use, funds that you can use for a little bit. But in the long run, what happens is your economic benefit is very short-lived, because you're not getting it at the rate you would have gotten if things were done properly. So that portion of benefit is very temporary and it's very short-lived, and I would go as far as saying it outweighs the residual impact that you are left with when these people pick up and leave.
Absolutely. And it leaves soil erosion as well, and also homes that could then collapse or and stuff like that. I want you also to get into detail with that, so that somebody who is in the village can understand just how very or can understand the negative consequences or the negative impact this can have on a community as a whole, as opposed to them receiving perhaps few bucks that you even say that they won't get a run for their money anyway. They will obviously just be given some sort of peanuts for that temporary comfort.
Well, I think this is not something that, it's not really new.
No, it's not.
It's something that the ministry has tried to combat for quite a long time. And if you remember, if you recall, some years back, a few years back, it was even prominent in the papers where you would see images of a homestead literally on the verge of collapse because the sand mining has gone into all the way invading into the space of the house.
Yeah.
So there isn't a protection barrier. The house can collapse. And so for you as the person that owns the land where the sand mining is being done, and mind you, a lot of times this is in communal land, you're losing land where you can grow your mahangu fields, where you can to feed yourself and your family, and also grazing land for yourself and your animals, or grazing land for your neighbors whatsoever. Now, the biggest one is where the illegal sand mining is done outside of somebody's private property, communal land, where it's in the public space. So in that public space where it's probably not fenced off, those queries create a risk for everybody. Because the moment you're sand mining, you're also going to have some form of deforestation happening. People will cut down trees to get to more area and go further into the soft spot where the land the soil is that you prefer. So for the adjacent communities or homesteads around those areas, they get impacted because the land degradation that's coming from that activity and the soil erosion and the inevitable loss of quality in the soil to be able to revegetate or plants to grow back in that area. It becomes a challenge, and it becomes that community needs to live with it. They've lost grazing land. Where they could probably 3-4 years ago, they could leave their animals grazing there because it's public land. Now that grazing land is not available anymore.
Yeah.
Where they could possibly have been able to collect firewood in that area because the trees have been cut down. And they can't do that because there are no trees to provide you with firewood now in that area. So there's an array of impacts when it comes to the community. And I think from the media release, I noted that the ministry said they're going to have stakeholder engagements. And I think those stakeholder engagements are quite key to help the villages understand, or the people in those communities understand really, not just the impact to them, but also the regulations and the law behind it.
Yeah.
Because by allowing someone to mine, you yourself are breaking the law. Because you're going against the set regulations of the Environmental Management Act.
Interesting. Now, Myla, just why are environmental impact assessments and environmental clearance certificates so critical before any sand or gravel mining begins?
So, I think before you even get to the impact assessment part of it, you need to understand that there is the Environmental Management Act already governs what is expected when it comes to activities that have environmental impact.
Yeah.
Now, the regulations in environmental management space, we generally refer to them as listed activities. So there's an array of listed activities that talks to anytime you carry out one of these activities, mining or sand mining in particular, also being part of those listed activities under the mining and quarrying activities. It requires you to do an environmental impact assessment, and that environmental impact assessment, environmental impact assessment will essentially lead to or get you your environmental clearance certificate. Mm-hmm. The process of the environmental impact assessment is to look at not just environmental impact, but also socioeconomic impacts of that activity. Mm-hmm. So in this instance, if an EIA is done, this will allow for all the environmental impacts, both negative and positive, to be assessed with grant and assigned mitigation measures. Mm-hmm. So for each one of those impacts, that will also hold the mining entity or the people conducting the mining accountable to ensuring that there's restoration or rehabilitation of the quarry that they've created in that area. And then the community itself is engaged during that process. They are informed of the activities, the impact, and their opinions and voices are also held or heard in that during that process.
Yeah.
So they can voice themselves as to how what do they feel about the process, what is their concerns, and also sometimes provide possible solutions for restoration for those different areas. So it's a critical process, and it's a requirement under the Environmental Act.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one thing that Namibia has had to the advantage, to our advantage, is that environmental considerations have been part of our constitution, at the conception of our independence and the conception of our constitution.
Yeah.
So it's not something that came in later. Mm-hmm. Regulations may have came in later, but this is something that we've embedded in at our independence and made commitments to ensuring that our environment is protected.
Mm. Interesting. Maila Mwashinange, thank you so much for making time for us right here on the Reading News Analysis. But perhaps maybe your just last few words before I let you go.
I think thank you also for having me, Happy. But I think that I would really leave with the listeners is that let's go out there and listen to this engagement. Let's engage the authorities. I give kudos to the ministry to ensuring that information is rightfully communicated.
Mm-hmm.
So it's critical for us to have these engagements. The stakeholder engagements also help build policy and frameworks around different regulations. So it's critical that community members do engage and do join the sessions when they do commence. It would be good for the ministry to have a list of dates and venues already set up so people can know when the engagements will happen in their areas. But at the end of the day, we as individuals are responsible for ensuring environmental protection.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just in the hands of line ministry, because we only have one Earth, we only have one Namibia.
Sure.
And if we destroy it, it's on us, and our children will have to bear the consequences, unfortunately.
Mm. Interesting. So, yeah. Thank you, Maila.
Thank you for having me, Happy. Have a good one.
Okay. Welcome back. And there we had it from Maila Mwashinange, also giving her insights and inputs in regards to what the ministry has put out there. Of course, joining us now telephonically is John Pallett, and he's an environmentalist. John, thank you so much for making time for us right here on the radar.
Yeah, pleasure.
Mm. Of course, we're talking about something that I believe environmentalists and geologists and all that deal with this aspect of environment and geography-related stuff are very familiar with, that is illegal sand and gravel mining. Let me just also hear your perspective on why it's quite dangerous when communities partake or engage in illegal sand and gravel mining, John.
Okay, so these riverbeds, you know, Namibia doesn't have many flowing rivers. We have many dry riverbeds. But actually, those are really important ecologically because there's normally groundwater underneath them. And they sustain a lot of trees, larger trees, which don't grow so well in our very shallow soil, often grow larger and more frequently along those riverbeds. So in fact, the concentration of effort on riverbeds for our sand, obviously that's the place where sand can be best extracted, but actually it poses a real ecological danger. And so I'm happy that the Environmental Management Act is actually taking this issue seriously. The Ministry of Environment is taking it seriously and trying to think about how best to tighten up the act to get better controls on sand mining.
Tighten up the act to get better control on sand and gravel mining. Of course, this act we're talking about is Act 7 of 2007. And I did ask Dr. Carol from the Ministry of Environment, Forestry and Tourism that we're now in 2026. I think it's long overdue, would you say? Because although they did say consultations are yet to begin this very month of January. What do you say on that?
Yeah, okay, I'm happy. I've also just seen the notices go out about that there is going to be a public consultation process. As you say, the Environmental Management Act has been in place since 2007, but actually the regulations came in 2012.
Okay.
And the Act has been in force for 13, 14 years now, and there's a lot of difficulties. People who deal with these with this act, the environmental assessment practitioners, there are lots of areas where it's kind of not well defined. There's grey areas in the act, and so it'll be really good for these environmental assessment practitioners to, like myself, to get an opportunity to point out where the act needs to be tightened up, and particularly the regulations. For instance, I can talk about some of the there's a list of activities which require an EIA, and that is a list which includes power lines and infrastructure development and all the various different kinds of developments which can happen. But if those aren't tightly defined about, okay, so it says that all power lines must get an EIA, but actually if you have a power line maybe just stretching for 2 kilometers, does that itself need an EIA, which can cost over $100,000. I mean, you need some sort of tighter definition in many of these things, and that is what I hope this review of the Act will achieve. So I'm all for it. I'm looking forward to taking part in the consultations, and I hope it is widely advertised that all the EAPs, environmental assessment practitioners who are involved with this Act, can all come along and give their opinion.
Just what perhaps, Palette, would you say is the best way that would benefit both local people in their communities who obviously would want to build their houses and, of course, want to be on the right side of the law? As these consultations are going to go about, what is it that you would also want to be included to benefit both parties? Should there perhaps be a particular area where they can then go and gravel sand, where they can get sand and gravel as well to build their homes? Or what's your take on that?
Yeah, okay. So sand mining is obviously something which does have to happen. I'm not saying I'm completely against sand mining because we need sand for construction. But it does need to go through a process where the right mitigations are in place. So if there are actively growing trees, tall trees in that area, that those kind of areas get excluded, because that is where you're getting the best kind of ecological advantage from the riverbed. I think people obviously need to comply with the Act, and a lot of sand mining is just small time builders who need a small bucket load of sand, and they go and grab it as they can from any riverbed. But that does need to be more tightly controlled, so that kind of irregular exploitation doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. And I think if it's more tightly managed by companies which have gone through the EIA process and gone through it properly, okay, then it's a good thing. Now, obviously, there's a lot of difference between an EIA, which is just a box-ticking exercise, where it's just a paper exercise and someone has gone through the motions, produced some cut-and-paste report, and then gotten environmental clearance.
Mm.
It is actually really important for environmental assessment practitioners to do their job properly and apply their mind to, well, what are the ecological advantages and disadvantages of doing it here?
Mm-hmm.
What are the social benefits and the social downsides about doing it here or there? So EIAs are often regarded as just some sort of irritation which has to be done to get through the permitting process. But actually, they serve a really important function in trying to keep our environment in a state where it will carry on providing for us into the next 20, 50, 100 years. We shouldn't just be grabbing what we can for immediate benefits and making problems which will occur later down the line.
You're right. John Pallett, thank you so much for making time. Perhaps your last words on this.
But before you let me go,
yes?
At the start, you introduced me as an environmentalist. Okay, now I do like the environment. I practice environmental stuff, and I am very much an environmentalist. But I think it's important to make a distinction between environmentalists and environmental scientists. So I am a person who looks at the evidence. I do EIAs. I look at the environmental situation in each particular case, and I make a judgment about that based on hard facts and evidence about what is good and what is not.
I see.
So environmentalists are often seen as these kind of tree huggers who want to stop all development. I'm not in that parcel of people.
Yeah.
I look at things objectively, and I try and make a kind of valid ruling on what is best for the environment. And often it's the case where, okay, some development which has been proposed is bad for the environment and can be done in a better way. And so we always try to make the case for doing things in a way which still can bring some kind of livelihood support and profit, but without damaging the environment unnecessarily. And that is the important point to make. Anyway, thanks. It's been nice to talk to Eagle. Thank you very much.
John, thank you. But you know what? A question is coming up in my mind now to see, a message to environmentalists themselves, because of course some companies can get somebody whom they know who is an environmentalist and qualified and all that, just because they want that clearance certificate, and they get it, but the assessment was not all factual and true. Interesting.
Yeah, that is a real problem in the environmental sector. There are a lot of cases where there's a kind of a sweetheart report is produced, and unfortunately the Ministry of Environment and Tourism isn't very strong at reviewing. I mean, its review process doesn't often pick up where there's completely fraudulent statements or things have been made to look better than they really are. So often it's the case where the environmental assessment practitioner, the EAP, is in the pocket of the developer, and he or she will not want to write a report which actually incurs more costs for the developer. But I just find, I mean, as true as that is, and as irritating as it is, EAPs must always remember that it is in Namibian society's interest to do a proper job in an EIA. We're all just too interested in chasing the quick dollar.
Yeah.
And making something possible for me now so I can get paid and don't want to cause the developer any hiccups. But actually, that's not in the long-term interest of us as Namibian people and as society and the environment in general. So that's a very short-sighted and, I would say, stupid view to take.
John, I hear you, and I love your honesty.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Thank you so much for making time for us.
Good. That's a pleasure. Nice to speak to you. Thanks, Happy.
Okay.
Okay, bye now.
Bye now.
And there you had it up from John Pallett. Now, of course, let's pause right here, take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back with news beyond the borders of Namibia. Also, some economic indicators coming your way. Now, remember, our studio line is open 083-288-401 is the number in studio. Please come through air opinions and contributions right here on the Reader News Analysis. Perhaps you do have a question yourself that you would want to ask. I'll see you after the commercial break.
Lipura nengelo wapubwa eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweku tete opoye ekukulile. Oshafafa na nongeshefa ili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshuana. Onongeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka. Okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi inawa. Nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshefa omarudi dayo loka. Opone ushendife nawa nokumona oijamo ili nawa. Ninge kwata fanona Monica ko Eagle FM onore tatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali. Ile kumberewa, mura hetatu natu, bali o hetatu watatu, o mafilane, Eagle FM, the eye.
Want to know about Namibia's latest business and economic news? Then look no further than the Villager newspaper. The Villager is an e-paper that is published every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for free, directly to your phone or computer. To become a subscriber, simply send a WhatsApp message with your number and email address to 081-200-4144. Be sure to save the phone number as a contact. The Villager, wherever you are.
Welcome back. Now for some economic indicators. We compare the Namibian dollar to other currencies. Now one US dollar today is equals to 16.40 Namibian dollars. £1 sterling is equals to 21.99 Namibian dollars. And one Swiss franc is equals to 20 Namibian dollars and 46 cents. One Australian dollar is equals to 11 Namibian dollars. And one Botswana pula is equals to 1 Namibian dollar and 23 cents. Now let's move over to news beyond the borders of Namibia. That is starting off in South Africa. We move, always start off regionally, move over to continental news. Thereafter, some international news. And now South Africa is dealing with illegal mining crackdown at Meltwater landfill site in Brakpan. Let's take a listen to that conversation that sounds very familiar to what we've been discussing all throughout within the borders of Namibia today.
The city of Ekurhuleni is conducting a joint law enforcement operation at Van der Weerden landfill site in Brakpan. This is part of ongoing efforts to restore safety, protect municipal infrastructure, and stabilize frontline service delivery. The landfill was closed in December last year following escalating safety risks arising from illegal mining on that site. The operation is seeking to address this as well as to restore order and enable further assessments. As you can see on your screen there, Mbalenhle Mthethwa is keeping up with some of these officers who I imagine are going through part of that site where this inspection is being conducted. Mbalenhle, what are you able to see there?
Well, what I'm confirming right now as we are walking here, we're walking from one shaft to the next, and I'm just going to step out of the shot. What you're seeing in front of us here is one of those makeshift mechanisms that are used in the cleaning of the gold that is illegally mined from the shaft. I'm going to ask my camera colleague to move closer to the mine shaft, and the police officer has just confirmed that there are gunshots being fired on the other side of where we are right now. We're going to go around this area as we move closer to the third shaft that we have seen so far since we have arrived. Now, the reason for this operation is because these illegal miners have somewhat stopped the work of the municipality and the work of the municipality in regard to having an operational landfill where they drop off all the rubbish and the garbage that is, or the refuse that is collected from, and it is brought to place. And I'm going to ask my camera colleague to show you. Right across, it is brought to this place. Some of it is brought to this place. and that is where it is kept. And there are those who survive by literally rummaging through the refuse and taking all of the recyclable items and then reselling them. However, what we have now established, as the Our Camera colleague turns around to show you the law enforcement around us, as well as the mining shafts that we are now seeing in front of us.
Now, since it's the beginning of this new academic year, that is 2026, let's take a listen to how AI tools are transforming learning.
Welcome back. Now, we saw this week South African children going back to school for the first week of the 2026 academic year. And the use of artificial intelligence in our education system has, of course, seen growth with new innovative and also digital tools taking over more and more of the traditional ways of learning and teaching in our schools. But many schools still lack adequate and reliable digital connections, thereby hindering school-aged children from fully utilizing artificial intelligence. But there are also many questions. How much does artificial intelligence matter inside the classroom setup? And how much does it matter in shaping future careers? Now, to help us answer some of these questions, we're joined in studio this morning by Pauline Gunene, who's Executive Director of Nagaro in South Africa. Pauline, thanks so much for coming through. Welcome to Morning Live.
Thank you, Sakina, for having me.
It's a very interesting discussion at the moment, but let me start by just gauging whether the Department of Education has an actual policy to deal with artificial intelligence in the classroom.
Yes, they do actually have a policy, but I think the issue is in implementation. So what we find is there are little pockets of world-class digital learning in South Africa, but if you go through to the public schools, there you'll find that they're still lacking stable internet access to devices as well as digital skills to actually relay those skills through to the learners. So yes, there are policies in place, but it's just a matter of access, a matter of the skills being relayed to the learners, and lack of access to devices. So it's actually the biggest barrier that South Africa faces, or the South African learners face, is not the ability. It's actually the access to the tools as well, as well as the digital skills.
And I suppose therein lies part of the problem, because yes, once again, that lack of access just perpetuates already existing inequality.
Inequality, yes.
Across our school system. But then, of course, there are other questions as well with regard to what would be, as per the policy, acceptable levels of AI-assisted learning as opposed to academic dishonesty altogether. It's a fine line, you know. You know, how does the policy guide in that regard?
Yes, there are governance AI and ethical use of that. I think the question lies in whether we are teaching them to use the AI responsibly. I think the AI itself helps in terms of guiding, giving access to homework, you know, guiding them with the research, improving their writing skills. But the person, the learner, if they are not taught how to use AI responsibly with the ethical guidance, then it becomes a little bit useless.
So that's the issue, isn't
yes,
it, Pauline?
Yes,
because
yes.
When you say, you know, learners are assisted.
Yes.
Someone comes, you quickly, you know, write the question, and you use, say, a ChatGPT.
Yes.
That can write the entire assignment for you.
Yes.
So how do teachers, one, you know, gauge that? How do they assess that, given that there is permissible use of AI? But how do you go about, you know, drawing that line in the sand once again,
yes,
with regard to what is permissible and when are you crossing the line?
So then again, just maybe reiterate the ethical guidance. So the various policies or governance policies that are in place should be taught. But remember, the human element remains essential as well. So the guidance from teachers, teaching them to still think critically. So AI still needs a person to think critically so that they inform ChatGPT and they give it gives them back the correct information. Part of critical thinking is also to do fact checking, because AI as it stands today, you still it may not give you the correct information, so you still need to have your research skills, you need to have a little bit of knowledge, so it doesn't really replace the human element of the teachers and the learners, so you still have to have that critical thinking in place.
You see, I'm confused because I can't see it in practice.
Yes.
Because, and I get what you're saying about critical thinking.
Yes.
And how you would then structure the question.
Yes.
That you ask ChatGPT to assist you with.
Yes.
But if ChatGPT is doing the entire write-up,
yes,
granted your point of yes, you still needing to do some fact-checking.
Yes.
who did the assignment?
Yes.
Is it the learner or is it ChatGPT?
Well, it would be a percentage of a contribution from both. I think if you're looking from a learner perspective, it would probably build their confidence skills and improve their writing skills, improve on how they should research. And then when it comes to the teachers, there are mechanisms to check whether they have used GPT solely or whether they also use some of their knowledge and their skills. So I think it is a balance that you need to have. And it can be a very powerful tool the inclusivity of the inclusive education in South Africa.
So in that space,
yes,
are you aware of INSET training for teachers?
Yes.
In this regard? And again, as a teacher, yeah, how do you know that one, a learner has used ChatGPT? Two, to what extent they have done this? And three, when you are actually performing the assessment, how do you weight the scoring then?
Yes.
For a learner that has been assisted, because they can be vis-a-vis a learner in the same class who may not have access because they go home and live in an area where there's no internet access and therefore they don't have the same access. If you're dealing with those dynamics in the same class,
yes,
how do you weigh that up?
I think, first of all, in the classroom or in a university setup, there will be rules in the school in terms of also the guidelines as well, in terms of certain assessments that they should be done in a certain way to achieve a certain outcome. Some of the outcome is also to build their knowledge, and some of it is to build their thinking, and some of it is to build their research skills, depending what the outcome is for that particular subject. So the school and the lecturer or the teacher will be the person to actually say, for this particular assignment, you are not allowed to use AI. So I think that with those guidelines, the ethical guidelines that will control and also level the playing fields for all the students.
And hoping the teacher would be able
and
to tell the
difference. And hoping he'll be, yeah, well, they do, because some of them do get penalized for when, because teachers do check. There are mechanisms, as I've already alluded to, where they check whether
what
AI
are those
has
mechanisms?
Been.
How can you pinpoint? How can you tell
yes,
that there's been AI assistance in an assignment?
So there's systems where you can check for plagiarism, where it does connect or trace whether you got the information from a reliable source or whether you've copied a paper that is already there. Because AI, remember, is a system that we feed it information. So if you are going to be solely relying on AI, it will then take from the various sources that it has been fed. And if you don't do the proper fact-checking and the proper reading through your assignment, then you will, without editing it, you will be found to have plagiarized the paper, copied somebody else's work.
Yeah, just also to extend on that answer that she gave, how perhaps lecturers or teachers can identify whether a student has copied a particular assignment using AI. One particular app or one particular aspect to do that, how lecturers used to do that, is Turnitin. And way back in 2017 when I was doing my course. I remember our lecturer then was really brilliant, hey, knowing that it's for some, they've only recently adopted it. So she signed up for Turnitin. And she is a lecturer and then got us, to sign up for it as well. So it's like, it was like a classroom thing, sort of to see. And then, we were now told to submit our assignments through Turnitin. And Turnitin would give you, as you submit, it will already count down at a particular time how many percentage of plagiarism you have done, whether it's 76%, 30%, and it will highlight exactly, where you got this from, and then it will give a source of where that came from. The nice thing about Turnitin is that, you could, you know, and for me, I think I became smarter around it. I would paraphrase it to make it my own words, put it in my own understanding as much as I got it, from that, from a particular site or a particular book. You know, that's how far is it, that's even how far it goes. Even if it's, you got it from a book, it was still pinpoint that you got it from, let's say, Mosby's paramedic book from so. So now, I came around that aspect of getting it in my own words, you know, putting together, taking one particular information from one source and another source and even three, four sources at one time and making it my own word in my own understanding. That helped me quite a lot. And as a result, my percentage of from Turnitin is for plagiarizing dramatically decreased, which was reasonable. And it's not something that I got penalized for. Another thing with Turnitin was that when she would put, if say the assignment is due tomorrow at 1500 hours, after 1500 hours, any late submission after that, it's a minus 5%. And that's just how it'll really just count down. After some particular time, you can't, submit that assignment anymore. So for those lecturers, teachers who would want to really employ this, well, to head over to Turnitin. Oh, and the other nice thing about it is that you can still access your documents that you submitted, 5 years from now. I'm talking about 2017, and I can still access those documents. Should I be interested in using them? Should I be interested in reading up on information on them and making use of them? I can still access them. Yeah. So really, as for AI, it really is helping people, and of course, doing. But we still need to do our part. Of course, in that aspect, we still need to do our part in order for us to really understand what is going on and to be able to really get it and grasp the minimum of what we are supposed to get from it. Now let's move over, still on news beyond the border of South Namibia. Concerns emerge over the implementation of the Nigeria-Morocco gas pipeline project. Let's take a listen.
$5 billion and a capacity of pumping 30 billion cubic meters of liquefied natural gas annually. The ambitious Nigeria-Morocco gas pipeline has been positioned as an alternative gas route to Europe from the heart of Africa at a time of heightened global energy uncertainty. While a final investment decision on the project is still in the works, some investors like the United Arab Emirates, the OPEC Fund, the European Investment Bank and others have pledged financial commitments.
This initiative is great. Sending it to Morocco, you know, Morocco now understands how to use its affinity and closeness to Europe. From Morocco to Europe, probably 20 minutes. So Morocco is now becoming a very big attraction, big commercial attraction for Europe and MENA.
And because this is also a project that cuts across 13 African countries, it is expected that African funding will also be put on the table. So the Afrexim of this world, the AFC of this world, the ADB of this world, those are all African financing, development financing institutions who will be required to pitch in into a financing like this.
But financing alone may not be enough. At the heart of the project is a question of gas supply and whether Nigeria can consistently deliver volumes at scale.
We don't have sufficient infrastructure to deliver gas to our own domestic economy. So it's frankly, even though it's a good idea, none of this really makes any sense until we get serious about making the necessary investments in infrastructure, making the necessary upstream investments in development of non-associated and associated gas to be able to fulfill our domestic obligations as well as our export aspirations.
As part of its decade of gas initiative to harness much of its 200 trillion cubic feet of proven natural gas reserves, Nigeria is ramping up investments in the country's gas sector. The government says it aims to unlock as much as $20 billion in new investments from 70 priority gas projects over the next few years.
Our gas production has also increased from about 6.5 million standard cubic feet to about over 7 billion standard cubic feet per day. So I think some of those are underpinned by very structural changes. We're also expecting to pull in additional investment, significant investment. We're expecting more investment decisions to come through.
Security is also a major challenge for the project. Large sections of the pipeline will run across regions affected by political instability and insurgency. But partners are undeterred by the challenge.
Even in countries where there are insecurity-related issues, this kind of discussions could still hold, in which the parties will deal with, even if it is warlords that are in those countries, will deal with those warlords to let them realize that, look, even you, as a warlord, your country needs this gas. Apart from that, this gas is a stabilizing factor across several countries, all the way into Europe, where it is leading into.
Construction of the pipeline is expected to begin after the final investment decision, with a completion date of 2046. Nigeria is counting on the project to help it monetize its huge gas reserves and reduce current massive flaring. Should the project come to fruition, the country would effectively be on the path to energy security. DG Bademasi, CGTN, Lagos, Nigeria.
Meanwhile, Sierra Leone, Science Forum is empowering students at community level.
Alice has a passion for science and has been eagerly awaiting the return of the Science and Leadership Festival in her hometown in northern Sierra Leone.
I went to the ICT and AI lab. We are in a learned about robotics and also smart agro farm. We are in about irrigation, how I managed to know how irrigation takes place in the particular agricultural farming system. I'm also for the central brain system, which is ESP32. The AI is here to help us well.
Organized by a community-led organization known as Project 1808, the festival transforms classrooms and open spaces into hubs of creativity, discovery, and empowerment.
As Africa works to build a future-ready tech workforce, innovation here is starting early. From science and engineering to arts, culture, and medicine, the children here are more than determined to advancing their community in solving real-world challenges.
Reflecting on the past, Professor Kawule Kamara says the festival fills the gap of what was missing in his day.
They never taught us anything about our history. There's nothing you learn about your history as Limba, as Franco, or as Fulas, or anything of the sort. It's all about European history, okay? About European history and stuff like that. And so while some of us were successful, it was a rarity.
Speaking to CGTN, the founder of Project 1808, Alhaji Njai, says the Science and Leadership Festival has evolved over the years, attracting delegates from the U.S. and the Mano River Union.
What we wanted to showcase here is that there is a fundamental and a significant role of culture within every discipline, but also that it is fundamental for national development.
Children at the festival are learning that great ideas don't have to come from far away. They can grow from what they know and where they live. Eric Awa, CGTN, Kabbalah, Sierra Leone.
Egypt signs a renewable energy investment deal with European and Chinese firms.
Achieve its goals for renewable energy to account to 42% of total energy production by 2030. Two $1.8 billion deals will go a long way in achieving these targets. First is with China Sungrow for assembling and producing solar panels in Egypt, the second with Norway's CATEC for a solar energy plant to generate electricity and energy storage stations.
Those two plants are a turning point for Egypt. To achieve our targets, we are forced to import solar panels and all components for clean energy. Today, with these two factories, Egypt enters the age of becoming a solar panel and renewable energy producer, and we will no longer spend hard currency for imports.
The North African country produces over 60,000 megawatts of electricity, while consumption exceeds 41,000.
Over 80% of the country's electricity production is powered by natural gas. The rest is from clean sources, mainly solar, wind, and hydro energy.
The government has been taking huge strides by providing tax breaks, favorable pricing terms, and building the proper infrastructure to attract investments to double renewables output, which is eco-friendly, more sustainable, and less expensive than fossil fuels. However, reducing natural gas consumption will allow Egypt to export its excess gas to increase state revenue.
Egypt is expanding with a dream to be a regional hub for all forms of energy. We import gas, liquefy it, and re-export it. We sign deals to import natural gas from Cyprus, Israel, and others to liquefy it in our facilities. We recently signed agreements to export to Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan, besides Europe. We are on the right track.
And China is a major contributor for Egypt's energy dreams.
China is not just important for Egypt, but for the world. It produces over 80% of solar panels and components globally. China also helps in the transfer of technology. There have been multiple contracts and more in the pipeline with China for technology transfer. Egypt can be a hub for Chinese companies to assemble and produce here and distribute to the region. China is open for this. China is essential for our success.
These plans will also be given a major boost after the opening of the Dabah nuclear energy plant in 2029, adding an expected 4,800 megawatts of clean energy to the electricity grid. Yas Hakim for CGTN, Cairo.
Meanwhile, Venezuelan Nobel Peace Prize winner gives a medal to Donald Trump.
The Venezuelan opposition leader Maria Corina Machado says that she has given her Nobel Peace Prize to President Trump. The pair were pictured in the Oval Office with Donald Trump holding a framed Nobel medal. The plaque said that this is in recognition of President Trump's principled and decisive action to secure a free Venezuela and how his courage will never be forgotten by the Venezuelan people. Well, the Nobel Peace Center stipulated in just the last few hours that while the medal can change owners, the title of the Nobel Peace Prize laureate cannot. The decision is final and stands for all time. Well, in the days that followed the U.S. intervention in Venezuela, Mr. Trump appeared to sideline Maria Corina Machado. He downplayed her support and instead supported the vice president, Delcy Rodriguez, now acting president, becoming the interim leader. Our North American editor, Sarah Smith, is in Washington.
Well, she has to try and stay on his good side because she has been completely overlooked so far by President Trump. And she wants to try to persuade him that Venezuela does need new elections, which she, of course, hopes that she would win. And that's why she got the Nobel Peace Prize in the first place, for her efforts to try and bring democracy to Venezuela. But we know all too well, don't we, that Donald Trump thinks he should have won that Peace Prize. So, you know, maybe it's not a surprise that she came here in order to hand it to him in the hope that that might help bring democracy to Venezuela.
And with that, we have now come to the conclusion of today's episode of On the Radar News Analysis. Do stay tuned for the Onkona Nadinge program brought to you by Loise Shimi. From Indafa Happy Juju, it is goodbye. I'll see you tomorrow, same time. No, not same time. From 1900 hours to 2100 hours for life lessons, same radio frequency, same Eagle FM app, and of course, same website. Goodbye.